Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are now known as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Keelan McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with the Museum of Political Corruption, which opens virtually with an event on December 9th. And then we learn about another event on December 8th, which is the PFAS Incineration Town Hall. Later on, Stephanie Dudek of Troy Public Library suggests books to read for December. After that, Beatrice Mendez Gandica of Microsoft talks about being focused on our communities, encouraging more women to pursue STEM careers and more. Finally, Triskele returns to talk about their newly released Christmas album. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that a number of RPI students are complaining about the college's mental health services. One complaint is the college frequently places students on involuntary leave, not allowing them on campus if they seek mental health treatment for concerns such as suicide. The Times Union said it talked to many students who are complaining about the experience is seeking treatment at the university's counseling center, explaining that they felt they received inadequate care, were belittled and dismissed by the staff, and or that the center was ill-equipped to deal with their problems.
The Gazette reports that the City Council in Schenectady is considering keeping marijuana dispensaries and on-site consumption facilities out of the city. At stake is the estimated $350 million in sales tax revenue cannabis sales are expected to generate in New York State. Local governments that opt out of allowing dispensaries and on-site consumption facilities will not receive any tax revenue associated with sales. Glenville and Niskayuna have all opted out in Schenectady County, while several municipalities have done so in Saratoga County.
The Schenectady School District is wrapping up the $65 million second phase the district's capital project approved by voters back in 2017. Phase one of the project, which saw $70 million in improvement to seven middle and elementary schools, were completed a few years ago. Construction in both Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Woodlawn Elementary Schools is in the final stages, while other schools are hoping to finish during the Christmas break.
Associated Press reports that with the Supreme Court expected to either overturn or seriously weaken the landmark 1973 Roe versus Wade decision, a resurgent anti-abortion movement is looking to press its advantage in state-by-state battles while abortion rights supporters prepare to play defense. It is expected that as many as 26 states would institute some sort of abortion access restrictions within a year, if permitted by the court. At least 12 states have trigger bans on the books with restrictions that would kick it automatically if the justices overturn or weaken federal protections on abortion access.
And our final headline comes from the Public News Service.
One of the major takeaways from last month's big climate conference in Scotland is all levels of government need to collaborate to address climate change. One small New York community is trying to do just that. Hastings-on-Hudson is 20 miles north of New York City, on the banks of the Hudson River. Due to more frequent extreme weather events, Mayor Nikki Armacost says flooding has become a repeat concern. So the town has adopted a climate emergency declaration, working with Westchester County to reduce greenhouse gases. Armacost says it's critical, even for small towns, to take climate change seriously because it's increasingly becoming something they have to deal with.
Arguably, it's one of the number one concerns of municipalities, big or small, and it's a direction that we should all be moving in. It's really, really important for our children, our children's children, for future generations, that we do whatever we can to address this issue.
She says the village is now working to draft a climate action plan with a focus on sustainable transportation and energy-efficient buildings. As the COP26 climate conference ended, the U.S. branch of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives released research on realistic pathways local governments can take to reduce per capita emissions by 63% or more by 2030 in order to meet Paris Climate Agreement goals. Angie Fife with the council says one way is through what's known as community choice aggregation, which allows governments to have a say in their local energy supplier.
That's a great way for a city to really lead by example and really demonstrate to the community that they're not only taking action themselves towards local environmental goals, but oftentimes these strategies will reduce the cost of operating city government.
She says Hastings-on-Hudson, which is powered by Sustainable Westchester, is among many New York towns that participate in community choice aggregation. This is Emily Scott reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And that's it for the headlines.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear? Find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
The Museum of Political Corruption will open up virtually with a Zoom event on December 9th. The event will reveal its first class of inductees into the Hall of Fame of Shame and the Hall of Honor. Latter will include Preet Bharara. The founder, Bruce Roeder, discusses the event with Mark Dunley of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We're joined by Bruce Roeder of the Museum of Political Corruption. Bruce has been with us a number of times over the years. And on Thursday, December 9th, they're having a launch of the virtual part of the museum. So why don't you, Bruce, give us a little overview. What exactly is the Museum of Political Corruption? And then what's the event coming up on December 9th?
On December 9th, we are launching our virtual museum, which will engage viewers in an understanding of what corruption is, in the fascinating history of corruption, and just as importantly, what people can do about corruption. We want them to leave our museum feeling somewhat empowered that there are things that we can do.
And so people can join this event virtually on December 9th?
Yes, absolutely. It is being live streamed on Zoom. The link will be available on our website on Monday. We are going to do a soft launch, and you will see at the very top of the homepage the link where you can register for the Zoom event, which is free and open to the public.
So some of us are wondering whether, is there a special wing for, Rensselaer County? We just had our county executive indicted for political corruption, Steve McLaughlin. And of course, we've had the legendary Joe Bruno and Ed McDonough Sr. both had corruption trials. How much? And of course, you go into Albany and you go to Rastus Cornyn and, of a balance you give to sort of some of the local corruption and then at the state capital and even federal?
Let's just put it this way. The museum was obviously inspired by my living here in Albany, New York. And we will, in fact, have an Albany room in our museum. It isn't fully developed yet. We are working on it. We still do have up our walking guided corruption tour of downtown Albany that people can take. And there's an audio component to that as well. But yes, in some respects, all politics is local. And we want to make sure that we focus on our local history too and inspire people from all over the country and all over the world to focus on their local politics as well. We shouldn't run away from our past, but we can certainly use our past to improve our future.
You know, and I always remember Steven Spielberg's movie, Lincoln. Lincoln's trying to ram something through Congress and he says, "Get me some Albany lobbyists."
Right.
Let's get them in here. They know how to get things passed through Congress. What are some of the highlights of the museum? Some of the real big political corruption stories you highlight.
Well, we are going to have the history of corruption exhibit, which will highlight many areas of corruption in the United States. It will go from the earliest colonial times all the way up through the Gilded Age era and the Teapot Dome scandal, all the way up through Watergate and beyond. So there are plenty of scandals that we can that we address and that we can learn from. What I'm really pleased about in our museum is that we are going to have a number of interactive exhibits too. We want our visitors to get their hands dirty. Why just save it for the politicians alone? So we will have exhibits on learning the language of corruption, all the various terms of corruption, what is bribery and extortion and emoluments and all those other good things. And so we do hope that people will not just browse, but will participate in our virtual museum.
Now, you mentioned, you know, Watergate, which, you know, some, you know, people, you know, view as sort of the height of political corruption, in that at least it ended up with, you know, Nixon resigning. And there definitely was a reform movement after Watergate, but it seems like we're sort of backtracking on corruption. It seems like this actually seems to be increasing, not decreasing.
Well, agreed, Mark. Corruption goes in waves. It goes in cycles. It never seems to go quite away. It's sort of like eczema, where, you know, you will get an outbreak and then it recedes, another outbreak and it recedes. And I know it's all very embarrassing, and it's probably worse than the dry weather. What we want to do with this museum is challenge that cycle and have in place a cultural institution that will address the subject on a constant basis. We're not waiting for the next headline to appear, or the next indictment of an assembly speaker or a Senate majority leader. We want to educate the public and prevent future corruption.
Has the State Museum reached out to you and say, hey, you know, we think this would be a great addition to the State Museum? I hear they are trying to upgrade it.
Well, not yet. That is definitely on our to-do list. We want to partner with the State Museum. We've had wonderful partnerships with other institutions here in Albany. We did an event with Albany Law School. We did another event with the Albany Institute of History and Art. Absolutely, the State Museum is on our list of people, of organizations that we want to work with.
Can you run us through the virtual event that's taking place on Thursday, December 9th? I understand you may have some interesting speakers joining you that day.
We have some wonderful speakers who will be helping us celebrate our opening. Our keynote address is being given by Richard Painter, who was the ethics attorney at the White House from 2005 to 2007. We're also going to be featuring two of our honorees. And I should tell you that this was top secret until I reveal it right now. We do have a Hall of Honor, and we will be inducting our first five inductees into the Hall of Honor. They include Preet Bharara, who will be offering some remarks, as well as Peter Eigen, who was the founder of Transparency International, and he'll be providing some remarks as well. We'll also be hearing from one of our advisory board members, Zephyr Teachout, who will also offer thoughts on how a museum like this can serve the public good.
Now, you mentioned Richard Painter. You know, my wife actually, you know, was a White House appointee during the Obama administration. She previously served, you know, several governors in New York. And one of the things she always says, she was very struck that when you know, she joined the Obama administration, they had a very serious presentation, it may have been by Richard, about the concept of ethics, and said, you know, if you ever are in a situation where you feel somebody's trying to compromise your integrity, please call me. Here's my home phone number, here's my cell phone number. And of course, the Obama administration largely, you know, went ethics scandals free, pretty unusual for a presidential administration.
No drama, Obama. I bet we miss those days. But that gets to another exhibit that I know we're developing, and that would be a virtual role-playing exhibit where perhaps you come into the museum and assume the role of a freshman congressman or a newly appointed judge or something along those lines, and then you're presented with a series of ethical challenges. How would you go about solving those challenges? One of your constituents comes and wants a job for their nephew or something like that, or a major donor. What would you do? And so we want to use the sort of training that government officials get and lead people through the ethical challenges and what would be the right decisions and what would be the wrong decisions in those matters.
So after the December 9th event, will people be able to just now access the museum virtually? It will now be online and they can...
For the event itself, I do plan on taking people on a virtual tour of the museum. That will be done primarily in a PowerPoint presentation, but it will only last about 20 minutes. And then what I would like to do is I would like to invite visitors to roam freely around the museum. Go visit the pages, go try out the exhibits, and then we'll reconvene for about the last 10 or 15 minutes of the session for questions and answers, or perhaps they have feedback. Well, maybe you can do your exhibit a little bit more like this, or maybe you can add this as well. And we would love to hear that from
time, unfortunately. Bruce Roeder, Museum of Political Corruption, Thursday, December 9th. How can people best access this?
You can go to our website, which is www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org, and you can find out more and you can learn where to register.
Thank you very much. This has been Mark Dunley with the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That link to register for this event is also included along with this segment on our website.
Capital Region resident Joey Ritchie and local filmmaker Dave Peblo will join Dr. David Bond on a panel on PFAS incineration hosted by Cancer Free Economy Network. In 2020, the Capital Region learned that the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes, New York, had burned PFAS containing firefighting foam from 2018 through 2019.
This Wednesday, December 8th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Cancer Free Economy Network will host a virtual town hall on PFAS incineration. The Capital Region learned in 2020 that the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes had been burning PFAS containing AFFF firefighting foam for 2 years. PFAS is a forever chemical that is bioaccumulative, meaning that once it enters your body, it accumulates and doesn't leave. For more information on Wednesday's event, we're joined by event panelist and Cohoes resident Joe Ritchie. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what Wednesday's event is about. Give us a preview.
Yeah, so Wednesday I was invited by some panelists, the Cancer Free Economy, to go to this event because of our experiences at Lights Out Norlite with the Norlite Hazardous Waste Incinerator, incinerating all of their AFFF chemicals. And I was invited because of my outwardly expression that what they did was wrong, and to provide a little bit more insight as to what the EPA should be doing national, what should be happening nationally, and what should be happening at the state level to protect the citizens who live nearby these areas. And oftentimes these people are of low income or are people of color. So I'm just here to provide voice for those who have not had their voices heard.
We're also joined by Capital Region resident Dave Peblo, who has been working on a documentary on this issue ever since we learned about the AFFF burning at Norlite. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks.
Dave, can you tell us, give us a preview about what you'll be discussing at Wednesday's panel?
Sure. I'm going to be talking mostly about some of the policy stuff that is behind how, you know, PFAS got to be such an issue. So I'll be talking about the Toxic Substances Control Act. And I'm mainly going to be drawing on the material that I came across in researching the documentary. So it should be pretty accessible to, you know, the layperson, because that's what I was when I came into this from the start.
Now, the Capital Region learned about Norlite's burning of AFFF in early 2020. Dr. David Bond, who will also be on the event on Wednesday, did a released samples of soil and water looking for PFAS chemicals. And then the DEC also did an 8-month study looking at soil and water samples. Is this issue resolved? What are the lingering questions for that concern residents near Norlite almost 2 years after we learned about this?
Well, yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, sorry. I'll say really quickly, you know, one of the issues is that there are no federal or state parameters to say what is dangerous and what is not. So a lot of times people can come up with their numbers, as the state of New York has, and has refuted these studies that Dr. Bond has conducted. And the issue is that people we are seeing, Dr. Bond and Bennington College has conducted near the Norlite area. And I think the EPA actually just came out within the last month that even lower quantities of PFAS are exceedingly dangerous. So there needs to be some direct action. What is really considered a dangerous level and some regulations that can finally say, these are acceptable levels and these are not. So we can stop playing this ping pong of what is dangerous and what is not.
Dave, comment?
Yep. So what I can add to that is that I definitely think that it's unresolved. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the DEC, when they did their supposedly comprehensive study of PFAS at Norlite, I think deliberately avoided testing two specific areas, which would have been hot spots for PFAS to collect. One of those is a thing that they refer to as the block mix pile. It's basically a massive pile of powdery hazardous waste that Norlite has been keeping in one location on the grounds of the Norlite plant for the last 30 years. And it's where all the residue from their pollution control system gets dumped. There's a legal exemption called the Bevel Amendment that supposedly allows them to use that material as a saleable product, but it's loaded with hazardous waste if it's, you know, based at all on what they have been burning over the years. And we're talking, you know, heavy metals, lead, arsenic, mercury, things like that. Basically, anything that their pollution control system captured would be in that pile. And then the other place, and so the DEC, when they were doing their comprehensive study, they did not test anywhere in or around that pile, despite them knowing, obviously, exactly how Norlite operates. And then the other place that they didn't test is in the Mohawk River near a location called Outfall 6. And Outfall 6 is where all the wastewater from that pollution control system was piped for, I'm not sure whether it's the full, you know, 3 decades plus of Norlite's operation burning this stuff, or, you know, whether it was, you know, more recent, but it definitely does include the period when they were burning PFAS. And so the likelihood of a water-loving contaminant like PFAS staying stuck to wastewater and making its way into the Mohawk and then thereafter into the Hudson is, I think, very high. So the DEC, I think, has been deliberately trying to mislead the public.
In 2020, New York State passed a state ban on burning AFFF, so Norlite will not be able to burn AFFF in the future, but we know that other incineration facilities in the United States are very likely burning this material and possibly other PFAS-containing materials. What sorts of lessons have we learned from Norlite that we want to see happen in or not happen in other areas of the U.S.?
Well, I think one of the biggest lessons that we can learn is that there has to be public input when this stuff is occurring. A lot of times this stuff goes behind the backs of residents who live literally 100 feet away. and they only find out that they've been drinking contaminated PFAS water 10 years later. It's unacceptable. This stuff should not be burned where people are living and or incinerated in general, because there is no science to support that these chemicals can be incinerated. They're meant to take out fires. They're not meant to be incinerated in a fire. So we really have to figure out what is the science saying, and how can we protect local residents who should not have to bear the burden of PFAS effects for years to come, if not for the rest of their lives.
Dave?
Yep. What I would add to that is that what's lacking in all of this, even at this late date, is transparency. And that is necessary for all of any sort of regulatory structure to succeed. So for example, David Bond, I think, would add that, in their studies, they found, first of all, the 2 million plus pounds of AFFF that the Department of Defense sent over to Norlite. But then they also found that there was at least 5.5 million gallons of tainted wastewater contaminated with PFAS that was sent to Norlite for processing. And they also found that there are essentially blending sites, right? So one of the things that the Department of Defense can do is they send their waste, and other entities can do this as well, but they send their waste to chemical mixing blending sites, and those sites basically sign off on the documents. So as far as Department of Defense is done, is considered, the issue is done. Then they take those materials, they mix them in with other substances, and then they ship those mixtures out to different incinerators around the country. Those incinerators are basically going through a channel that is on paper completely above board. And so they don't have to be concerned about necessarily what's in those wastes, because they're supposed to fit within certain parameters. In that sense, it's possible that Norlite even now is receiving like those blended mixtures and incinerating them, and they might contain PFAS. They don't know. So all of this stuff needs to be just completely transparent to the public, not just the regulatory bodies, but to the public at large.
To see a map of where those fuel blending sites that Dave is referring to and other incinerators that have accepted PFAS containing AFFF, you can go to bennington.edu/AFFF. And we'll go to Joe for the final comment. Joe?
Yeah, and I would also like to add too, with Norlite, a lesson that we can learn is that the state of New York literally had no idea if incinerating AFFF at Norlite would work. We were able to successfully find emails through a FOIL, Freedom of Information, and they pretty much were going back and forth with Norlite to see if this would work. And they admitted to Norlite that, well, there's no evidence to suggest that this could work, but it would be great to see if Norlite could do it. So let's stop using local residents as your guinea pigs for these tests and conduct them in the appropriate locations that they should be conducted, either in a lab or a controlled environment, not in the open air where people, children, elderly are living.
So Dave Pueblo and Joe Ritchie will be panelists at the PFAS Incineration Town Hall happening Wednesday, December 8th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can register at facebook.com/lightsoutnorlite. And I want to thank Joe and Dave for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have been covering the story of PFAS in the area quite consistently, and you can find more of those stories on our website. And on their website, you can also find this segment, and if you look in the descriptions, there is the link for the registration for this event, which is happening on Wednesday, December 8th at 6:30 p.m. EST.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, warm regards, or even a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
Ready to curl up with a hot chocolate and a novel? Bria Barthel returns to the Troy Public Library for another Talking About Books with Stephanie Dudek of Troy Public Library.
Hi, I'm Bria Barthel, and today I'm talking about books with Stephanie Dudek, Head of Reference and Adult Services at the Troy Public Library. Stephanie, thanks for coming back. Let's hear what you have for us today.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I'm here to tell you about a couple books today. The first one I'm going to talk about is called The Snow Child by Ewan Ivory. This is a very good winter read. It's a few years old. It came out in 2012, but it's an excellent alternative to the more syrupy Christmas books and movies that come out this time of year. It's quickly becoming a modern classic. It's a character-focused book. Its plot unravels slowly over the course of many years. It has kind of a magical quality to it, fairy tale-ish, but stays grounded in reality. It's about a childless couple that in the 1920s who are living on the Alaskan frontier. They're trying to make it on their own farm. They are hoping for a child. They go out one day on the first snow of the year and they build a small snow child just for fun. And the next day the snow child has vanished, but they start catching glimpses of this little girl running through the forest. And they have repeated encounters with her, and her reappearances always brighten the couple's somewhat bleak existence out in this wilderness. This book explores the couple's struggles with loss, loneliness, and how human connection and hope keeps us afloat. I really recommend it. It's a great read for the winter time. The second book I'm going to talk about is our book club pick for our upcoming meeting on January 10th, and that's at 6:30. The book we're reading for this month is A Long Petal of the Sea by Isabel Allende. It's a historical fiction book set in the 1930s as the Civil War grips Spain. When General Franco overthrows the government, thousands are forced to flee. It centers on the characters Rosa, a pregnant widow, and Victor, an army doctor, brother of her deceased love. They marry under tragic circumstances, and with other refugees, they embark on a journey on the ship, the SS Winnipeg, to Chile to start over on a new continent. So I'm really looking forward to reading that one for January, and hopefully you'll join us.
And that day again is January 10th at 7 p.m.? 6:30 p.m. Okay, now in addition to the books, you have lots of other materials available through the library. I was thinking perhaps today we could talk a little bit about the magazines and other materials online through a couple different portals.
Yes, we have our Libby app. It's a free app that you can download from the Google Play Store or the Apple Store, depending on what device you have. And that allows you to check out not only books and audio books, but magazines. They're available through the Upper Hudson Library System. There's a wide variety of magazines. In addition to that, we do have some other things to check out that will help you get through the winter. We have our Museum Pass program. We have a wide variety of museum passes. We lend them out for 3 days at a time. That should hopefully give you enough time to make travel plans and experience the museum and then get the pass back to us so we can pass it on to someone else. At this point, we're still recommending everyone calls the museum they intend to visit ahead of time just to check on their current COVID procedures, etc. The passes are good for different things depending on which museum you're visiting. Some have a pass that is free for an entire family unit, and then there's others that they only give you a discount on the pass, so check on that as well when you come check out a museum pass. We have the ever-popular Massmoca pass and a pass for the Clark Art Institute, which are ever-popular. We also have the Albany Art Institute, which is a little closer to home, and the Children's Museum at Saratoga and the Eric Carle Museum. So hopefully there's something for everyone.
Great. And part of your work is reference services. I imagine with what my sister calls Dr. Google, that you may not be getting quite as many questions through reference services. What are some of the most interesting things that have come up in the last little while?
Ooh, the most interesting things. There's always unexpected things. People call needing directions or phone numbers to doctor's offices. We have one gentleman that calls in fairly frequently, hoping to find out information on a wide variety of topics, including the Renaissance era and evolution. I'm not sure what he's studying, but it seems very interesting.
Okay. Thanks so much, Stephanie. And this is Bria Barthel talking about books and beyond with Stephanie Dudek, Head of Reference and Adult Services at Troy Public Library. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this segment occurs every month. We talk books every month. For more book recommendations from Bria Barthel and Stephanie Dudek, go to our website, and there'll be more segments. Heading to the next segment.
So in this segment, Beatrice Mendez Gandica talks about her work at Microsoft and many nonprofit organizations she's involved with. She's very focused on her community and encouraging more women to pursue STEM careers. And she talks about what it means to be a role model.
I'm Gabby Hall, and today I'll be interviewing Beatrice Mendez Gandica from Microsoft about her work at Microsoft and what it means to be a woman in STEM. Thank you for joining us, Beatrice. To start us off, could you just talk a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
So my name is Beatrice Mendez Gandica. I go by Bea. And what I do is I'm a senior program manager at Microsoft. And I work on a brand new team that is on Azure, which is Microsoft Cloud, that focuses on billing. So how do we aggregate data in terms of usage and then send it to the customer? That's what I work on. So you can think of it about some sort of like big data team. That's what I've been working on. And then I also run a nonprofit, a 501c3 called Nueva Foundation, where we teach kids that come from underrepresented backgrounds how to code.
That's awesome. What inspired you to start the Nueva Foundation?
Yeah, so I learned how to code in university. So for some, that's pretty late. There's all the people that are in the same boat as I am. But I wanted to give opportunities to the next generation of students, opportunities that I didn't have. So for me, it's important that kids that are in elementary or in middle school or in high school have at least some sort of introduction or some sort of classes where they can see what computer science looks like. And then they are well informed to decide if this is for them or not. If it is, awesome, at least you know. And you don't have to wait for me till you go to college to find out. And if it's not, that's fine too, but at least it's a decision based on something that you try and not a decision based on the unknown or just thinking that coding is for certain people or for certain gender or for certain X, Y, or Z. So I think that that's part of the inspiration. And second, I grew up in a family where we were very into giving back. Just if it's food or if it was time or if it was medicines or a visit or anything like that. That was very something close that I did with my grandpa. So I had to give back, and that was one of the ways that I figured that I could help out the community.
That's beautiful. So your whole goal with the Nuevo Foundation is to inspire people to get into computer science, or just to expose them to, you know, what computer science is like. So for you personally, how did you get into computer science?
How I got into it was in college. I broke a computer, we got it to work, and that was super fun. But for me, it has always been, I like the impact that tech has on people's life. I've been working as a PM for a while now, and I enjoy it. But in terms of like computer science, I took some classes in college, but I went for school for something called information systems. So it's not quite computer science. So it's half like computer science and half business. And that's the route that I took. Again, I wasn't sure that there was a subject or a career called computer science. Mm-hmm.
So you're clearly very, very involved in the community. What does community mean to you?
So for me, it's the people that you somehow are close by because of either nationality, race, language, food, your passion, something in common, some sort of cause. So where there's something in common, you might not agree 100% with the other person, but there's something bigger than those disagreements that keeps you together. So for me, my community is folks that are underrepresented, folks that are Latino, Hispanic, woman, and then other communities, like I go to the gym, so I like people that also like to work out, I play racquetball, I like to travel, those kind of things. But it's something that, some sort of similarity that you share, or some passion that's similar to other folks.
So do you have a mentor or someone that mentored you? And if so, what do you feel the value of mentorship is?
Yeah, I've been super lucky and have many mentors across my career and also in college. I think that folks that are listening to this should find a mentor. A mentor can be your parents, can be your uncle, can be your cousin, can be your teacher, can be your professor at college that you get along with. But also, you can get along with that person, but that person also have to be someone that can tell you when you're going in the wrong direction, that you're going in the wrong direction. And also you should be able to take it. And something that I also think about mentorship is not just one way. It's not because someone is older than you, or because someone has a title, or because someone this or that. It's only that person helping you out. I think when mentorship works at its best is when it's bidirectional, where you have certain things that you can help your mentor with, and then you're taking in from that mentor some other skills as well. But that's what I've seen, that it works great. And sometimes you need a mentor like every week. Sometimes you need a mentor once a year. So it really depends on the skills that you're looking for, that you're trying to improve, or that you're trying to get better at, for you to have that need. But I suggest at least you have three. If you can have more, absolutely. But someone that is on your same line, meaning focus on the type of work or the type of career or the type of specialty that you're looking for, someone that has not that necessarily the same line, but part of the same industry, if you're at work, and then somebody else more on your personal growth. I think like once you're in college, you experience certain aspects of life, but then once you start working, something else happened, right? And how do you handle that? And I think that was useful, at least for me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're working at Microsoft now. How do you feel being a Latino woman is impacting your role within Microsoft?
So for me, the most important thing is, how do we make sure that I'm able to bring other women and other Latinas to tech? That to me, it's something that's important to me. I want to make sure that we have the entire rainbow in every team. Not just one color, not just one race, not just one gender, but how do we make sure that we're truly diverse and also inclusive when it comes to the workplace?
So you say that you work doing that you work on the Microsoft Azure. So what does your day-to-day look like, if you can give me some kind of idea of that?
Yeah, so Azure is huge. Like, you have a lot of services that start from something like a SQL database to a virtual machine to a Power BI. So there are a lot of teams in Azure. A day in the life of a PM or a program manager, that really depends on the team. There are going to be PMs that check in code. There's going to be PMs that never touch the code. There's going to be PMs that talk to customers. What I'm currently doing right now is trying to work with internal customers to get it onboarded to our platform. Typically, you have a scrum or multiple scrums, depending on how many projects you're involved, where people share where they are at, if there's something that they are stuck, and then how do we solve it. Then some customers' conversations that happen, and then time to work on my projects that I'm helping the team with. So that's a typical day. If I was in the office, there's also, like, you typically go to lunch with your coworkers or with your friends. There's also Xbox lounges. So that is fun. Not that you play all the time, but you do get the opportunity to play from time to time. And there's also a lot of groups within campus that meet, for example, if you like Ultimate Frisbee or you are into playing board games or anything that you're into, there's a group of folks within Microsoft that do these kind of things. So that's always fun, based on anything that you are passionate or that you like it. And I think that that's great.
It seems like there's very strong communities within Microsoft, just within the whole, like, there's clubs kind of things, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So going beyond your work at Microsoft, I've noticed that you have worked as an ambassador for organizations like NCWIT, Career Girls, If Then. So what does it mean to be a role model or an ambassador? And how can listeners use these kinds of services or these platforms to help themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that sometimes you look for people that look like yourself, or that eat like yourself, or that speak like yourself. And so for me, is if I can bring a woman to tech, that is great. That is success. How do we reach parity? That would be great. But these organizations, what has enabled me is, how can we do more outreach?
This was the third part of this interview with Beatriz Mendendez Gandica by Gabby Hall for the series Notorious SHE, and you can find more on that series on our website.
Tris K. Lee is just released a Christmas album which continues to share their Irish tradition with the capital region. My co-host for tonight, Sina Bazilla Hickey, spoke with Nolene, Jen, and Sharon about the importance of family, their traditions of Christmas, and song and food as a way to pass on the tradition.
We're joined today by Tris Cayley, the premier all-female Celtic band out of Albany, New York. They are coming out with a Christmas album. And before we introduce the band, let's get a little taste of what it sounds like.
Eha Kyolvith Day, Christmas is a coming. Eha Kyolvith Day, Christmas is a coming soon. Let us all rejoice together, not just one day of the year. With our family and our loved ones, let us celebrate and cheer.
Hi there, my name is Jen, and I'm the youngest of the group, and I do vocals, and I play whistles and flutes and various percussion.
Hi, I'm Nolene. I am the oldest of the group, but I'm the youngest of 16, originally from Dublin. I'm authentic Dublin and proud to be Irish, and I play the baron, and I sometimes play guitar, if Sharon lets me.
And she sings.
And I sing. I sing a lot of lead singing. So.
Can you tell she's youngest? Anyway, I am number 4 out of 5 in my family, if you want to go there. And I'm on the middle of this group, I guess. I don't know. But I play the 12-string guitar mainly, and some other instruments as well. So, but the main thing is our harmonies and singing in the Gaelic and the
the wee wit.
So you mentioned family, and I think when we talk about the holidays, family is a really important part of it, whether it be genetic family or found family. How have your family dynamics been a part of Christmas and this album?
I have to say that we've been together almost 13 years now.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Oh, jeez.
Yes, oh, I know. Jesus, and we Mary, still like each other, I think. Nolan and I started the group, and the intention was really to have three for the Triskelly symbol, but we ended up with
becoming family together.
Becoming family. So a lot of people were not believing that we could stay together because they all said, well, you're a girls group, right? And they said, you know, girls are too catty. We have risen above this because we are resilient, loving people. And we have learned to work through all of those lovely things that we have talked about.
You know, but Christmas to us is, it's really about spending time with family and our, you know, our chosen family, our friends also, and different traditions we like to keep. In my family, we Christmas Eve is like the big thing for our family because everyone would come to my house. My mom would make all those special Christmas Eve, you know, dishes. And then Christmas Day was like, okay, you open the presents. You did this, you did this, you go to church. But that was my family. How about you, Nolan?
Well, the reason I wrote the song, it's called Christmas Is A Coming. Growing up in Ireland, we had all these traditions, you know. Here, I just wanted to, you know, I found that in America, we all get together, but only one day of the year we all rejoice. And I was just thinking, like, why can't we all rejoice, not just one day of the year, but all year long together? And we're all busy baking our pies and puddings and, you know, making gifts for our loved ones. And at the end of the day, let's all rejoice and let's have peace and love in our hearts. And let's have no more hate or angry feelings, because in our family, being the youngest of 16, there's always anger, there's always fighting. And just, you know, Christmas is coming. Let's rejoice, not today, but all year long. And that's what I was hoping for. And that's what Christmas Is Coming is about.
Oh, that's great.
So our group has always really tried to stay, how would you say, spiritual, very grounded.
Family-oriented.
And family-oriented. We always have children at our gigs. We have old people, young people, different types of cultures, because we speak to that universality. And I just love the fact that we are asked to do weddings, birthdays, funerals. We are asked to be a part of people's personal, intimate experiences.
So a lot of your music is traditional, our traditional Irish songs that we've history and traditions and growing up in Ireland. And storytelling generally, whether it be music or not, is about connecting, I think, through generations and through our ancestors. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of connecting through generations and passing down songs?
Nolan, would you say something?
We have a very special song on our new CD, Christmas Is A Coming.
Yeah, which is I just spoke about. But growing up in Ireland, we had no television. I hate to age myself, but growing up in Ireland, we had no television. We sat around the fire and our stories were told by my father, my mother, and it was just all about the different traditions of what we did, and just went on from generation to generation. And those are what are near and dear to my heart. And
each of your kids, each of the kids had a song that they had specifically sang. Yeah.
And if you're sitting around the fire, the tradition is everybody has their own party piece. And, you know, over here, if you're in America, you'll hear people, does anybody want to sing? And nobody puts their hand up if you're at a party. Like, but if you're in Ireland, in my house especially, does anybody want to sing a song? It's my turn. No, I was. You sang a song. It's my turn. Everybody wanted to do their party piece. And that went down through generation to generation. All my brothers, I'm the youngest of 16, and we all had our own song that we sang. And that was our tradition. And the baking of the puddings and the Christmas puddings, that was before, like 6 weeks before Christmas. You make the puddings and they sat in cheesecloths before Christmas. And the smells and the aromas and the spices. And, you know, that was the smell of Christmas. It was just that lovely, you know, feeling, the warmth of the holidays.
So another sensory aspect of tradition, the taste buds in addition to the auditory.
Yes. Uh-huh. The whole thing. Yeah.
But the one special song on our album that we're very proud of is we were able to ask Nolene's granddaughters to come on, and they actually came to the recording studio and they recorded a song with us that they have been singing with us on stage for the past, I would say, eight years. And it's all in Gaelic. So, you know, through all these years, they learned the song in Gaelic through their mother, who is Nolene's daughter. So, and then they come up on stage, they all sing it together. And to have it full circle, to have Trinity and Fiona to come on up and sing the song in Gaelic, and it's now forever in the on CD. Yes, with us.
Well, it's called "Cae Mila Fáilte, Baby Jesus." So it's 100,000 welcomes to Baby Jesus. You would sing it in Ireland when you're making your first Holy Communion, but you would also sing it at Christmas time, just welcoming Baby Jesus, you know, when he's born in the manger.
So has this Christmas album been released, and are there any performances coming up?
The Christmas album is released. You can pick up our CD at any of our performances. And then our CD release parties, official release parties, are going to be the 11th, which is a Saturday, at Celtic Hall, sponsored by Irish American Heritage Museum. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to be having our second release party at the Parting Glass Pub up in Saratoga Springs, 7 to 9. And for all of these, please call for reservations.
And Sina, at the end of the CD, people don't know it, but there are a few wee jokes. Just saying.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were joking before this interview, so I don't even think the listeners really got the just the fun that the three of you are. So I feel like that's important to get across.
Thank you very much for having us. We'd love to come on again. We're very rooted in the history of Irish in not only the capital district, but beyond.
And the language of Irish.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Tris Kaylee. Thank you, Jen, Sharon, and Noeline. Really appreciate you coming on and looking forward to hearing more of your music.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, 105.3, The Sanctuary.
Christmas is a coming. We have fuels a day. Christmas is a coming. We have fuels.
That was the second part of my interview with Tris Kaylee, and they spoke about the origins of their group, Music Therapy, and you can hear more of their songs, about the band, see photos, events. The website is reverbnation.com/Tris Kaylee, which is T-R-I-S-K-E-L-E.
And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, also your engineer.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe and stay warm.